Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never. And we've come to August 22nd. I should probably have some music to kind of help bring out the drama of the, I'll just say, the debates in the Constitutional Convention. Now, let me ask you this. This is 1787. There have been many, I'll call them academics. There have been many, you know, very brilliant people that had taken positions regarding slavery as, you know, as potentially, and because I don't know all of them, you know, many of them did not have slaves. In other words, it's easy to talk about somebody that you've never walked in their own shoes, if you understand what I'm saying. So, I mean, it's easy to tell somebody what to do, but it's a lot different when, you know, you're actually living those circumstances and in the midst of those. My point is this, folks. Nowhere in any history of Europe or anywhere in the world that we know of at this time. And this is to basically break the argument of academia today. These radical leftists going around teaching how racist these men were. There were racist people at the time, just like there are today. Just like those people who point the finger out that you're a racist, 9 times out of 10, they've got those other fingers in their exact same hand pointing back at them. I learned that from my father. Never point your finger at people because you're likely to have those, you know, those same, you're guilty of the same things or similar. So the point is this. Show me in England, show me in Parliament, where the representatives of the people and the aristocracy were trying to eradicate slavery. And I'll show you a manufactured document. But I am showing you from Madison, who captured the essence of this position and this argument back in the days when they were framing this new nation. Oh my gosh. Folks, you cannot have anything clearer. The majority of the men were really against slavery. The only reason slavery was maintained was they valued the Union more. They recognized that more and more states were abandoning slavery. I'll repeat that. More and more states were abandoning slavery. We already proved this in the ratification debates when the southern states basically said it, most of them are leaving, you know, they're abandoning it. We better, and this was the argument, and I agree that had they not jumped in and ratified, I mean, there was this huge dark cloud over this concept that the Constitution may not even be ratified. Because of this issue, because of other issues. So they really did everything they could to create a very limited government, and they left slavery to be a state issue, that the federal government was hands-off, that the federal government only placated the South by giving them a diminished representation. And we actually proved that what ended up happening in the Constitution by shutting down the slave trade and limiting to the 3/5 and so forth, that they were going to actually have to give up slavery until the Missouri Compromise. Ah, the corruption starts stewing in D.C. Now, and let's be clear, the Democrats and the progressives and the elitists, they were the ones in support of slavery. when I say the elitists, these people that believed, I mean, George Fitzhugh was a professor in the South. And I wrote about this in my first book, that here was a man that basically said, all people that do not have the ways and means, in other words, because they didn't come from good stock, all people should be slaves so that they could be taken care of better. It shouldn't be just for blacks. It should be for all people. And that right there is a statist ideology, that the few will take care of the hosts. Anyway, I want to dive into this because, again, this is really where this ultimate position is taken. And this is where they just finally acknowledge the fact that they just cannot get rid of slavery in the Constitution. And it goes like this. So this is, again, Wednesday, August 22nd. Read these things. Don't take my word for it. As a matter of fact, you hear me struggling in reading this. You have to at least acknowledge that this isn't the easiest thing to read, especially when you read it. But if you read along with me, you'll be able to see my errors and what have you. But more importantly, you'll actually see that these are the words of these men. I'm not making this up. I want you to take their word for it. Not mine. Okay, so Wednesday, August 22nd, 1787. Again, this type of conversation has never occurred in the annals of history of government of men. Now, there have been actually conversations that have been contrary to this, like when the king and or in Rome or the Egyptian Empire, when they deliberately started enslaving people and using it as a divisive mechanism and so forth. I mean, it was pretty evil how, you know, the Egyptian Empire, the Romans, how all of these different societies used slavery. And let's not forget, the society today that still maintains the paradigm of slavery is Islam. Yes, Islam is still practicing slavery today, my friends. But anywho, this is about property and the compromise of slavery. In convention, Article 7, Section 4, resumed Mr. Sherman stead. Mr. Sherman was for leaving the clause as it stands. He disapproved of the slave trade. Yet, as the states were now possessed of the right to import slaves, as the public good did not require to be taken from them, as it was expedient to as few objections as possible to propose the scheme of government, he thought it best to leave the matter as we find it. He observed the abolition of slavery seemed to be going on in the U.S., that the good sense of the several states would probably by degrees complete it. He urged on the convention and the necessity of dispatching its business. So in other words, Mr. Sherman from Connecticut was the one that basically says, we just need to leave this alone. I disapprove of it, but we're just going to leave it because we've created a cap for this. Because at this point in time, they capped it to 20 years. Now, Colonel Mason basically says this. These are the famous words. The infernal traffic originated in the avarice of British merchants. The British government constantly checked the attempts of Virginia to put a stop to it. Did you hear what I just said? The British government constantly checked the attempts of Virginia, to put a stop to it. We're talking about the slave trade. The present question concerns not the importing states alone, but the whole Union. The evil of having slaves was experienced during the late war. Had slaves been treated as they might have been by the enemy, they would have proved dangerous instruments in their hands. This is the inevitable. But, and you know what, folks? Our children are slaves to the progressives, and they have no idea this. They're slaves. And this is why I'll go back to why Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2, needs to become the song and the mantra, because we want kids to realize that they're being given thought control. We want people, and you know what? All you need to do is come up with basic definitions and basic ways of showing children how to start using critical thinking. Teach your children critical thinking, and they can actually start recognizing the thought control. All we have to do is do a little bit of our job. We'll get into that on Feedback Friday. But their folly dealt by the slaves as it did by the Tories. This is, again, Mason. This is Mason saying this. He mentioned the dangerous insurrections of the slaves in Greece and Sicily and the instructions given by Cromwell to the commissioners sent to Virginia to arm the servants and slaves in case other means of obtaining its submission would fail. Maryland and Virginia, he said, had already prohibited the importation of slaves. Expressly, North Carolina had done the same in substance. All this would be in vain if South Carolina and Georgia be at liberty to import. The Western people are already calling, so literally, why did North Carolina, if they, on principle, on paper, they were looking to move away from this. As he just kind of divulged, it was more of the two states with, North Carolina just, we're going to be supportive of this. And when you go through the debates, you can kind of see how South Carolina is far more fixated on the slavery side and those issues than North Carolina. North Carolina really dives into the need for the Bill of Rights and all those other arguments. South Carolina, not so much. And Georgia, they rubber stamped it because they knew that this was their protection. Anyway, the Western people are already calling out for slaves for their new lands and will fill that country with slaves if they can go through South Carolina and Georgia. Slavery discourages arts and manufacturers. The poor despise labor when performed by slaves. They prevent immigration of whites who really enrich and strengthen a country. They produce the most pernicious effect on manners. Now, this is it right here. Every slave master is born a petty tyrant. They bring the judgment of heaven on a country. As nations cannot be rewarded or punished in the next world, they must be in this. By an inevitable chain of causes and effects, Providence punishes national sins by national calamities. Right there, he basically said, this is a sin. And then Madison kind of, I'll just say, editorializes what, Mason is exhibiting here. And he basically says, he lamented that some of our Eastern brethren had, from a lust of gain, embarked in this nefarious traffic, as to the states being in possession of the right to import. This was the case with many other rights. Now, to be properly given up, he held it essential in every point of view that the general government should have the power to prevent the increase of slavery. Right there, he just laid it out. And so this kind of sets the tone, and it actually dominates the tone for quite a while, because here's a man that just poked many people in that room in the eye. Now, Mr. Ellsworth of Massachusetts, he's the first one. And again, Mason was an anti-federalist over the issues of a Bill of Rights and so forth. I mean, I always refer to him because he used hyperbole to try to make his points. And when we go through the ratification debates, anything that I read of Mason, I actually point out that if you listen to what he says that the government is going to do, it's a direct violation. Like when he talks about the recipe of getting rid of the militia. Well, the only way they could do that is they would have to directly violate the Constitution to ignore the arming and the disciplining. And so, in other words, if they're following the Constitution, we would have never gotten rid of the militia. Anyway, Mr. Ellsworth, as he had never owned a slave, could not judge the effects of slavery on character. He said, however, that if it was to be considered in a moral light, we ought to go farther to and free those already in the country. as slaves also multiply so fast in Virginia and Maryland that it's cheaper to raise than import them, whilst the sickly rice swamps, foreign supplies are necessary if we go further than is urged. We shall be unjust towards South Carolina and Georgia. Let us not intermeddle. As population increases, poor laborers will be so plenty as to render slaves useless. Slavery in time will not be a speck in our country. Provisions is already made in Connecticut for abolishing it, and the abolition has already taken place in Massachusetts, and the danger of insurrections from foreign influence will become a motive to kind treatment of slaves. Now, Ellsworth is almost kind of placating and saying, yeah, I'm okay with this. And he basically says the same thing that, you know, we're going to get rid of this in time, just like Sherman. Now, you remember, both of those men, Connecticut and Massachusetts, are up on the north, you know, the extreme north of the colonies or the states at this time. Mason is right there in the heart of it. I mean, Virginia is the border state to all of the slave states. And so Mr. Pinckney of South Carolina states this: if slavery be wrong, it is justified by the example of all the world. He cited the case of Greece and Rome and other ancient states, the sanction given by France, England, Holland, and other states. Now, let me point out, Holland was never a slave state, but Holland absolutely held to the right of property, and they honored slave owners and maintained. In other words, if you went to Holland, a slave couldn't run away. If they ran away, Holland would, you know, the authorities would turn that slave back over to the master. They respected slavery. They didn't practice it, but they respected it. Now, in all ages, one half of mankind have been slaves. If the southern states were let alone, they will probably of themselves stop importations. Now, he's basically baiting here. He would himself, as a citizen of South Carolina, vote for it. An attempt to take away the right, as proposed, will produce serious objections to the Constitution, which he wished to see adopted. In other words, he's, you know, putting this fear back in there. You know, we may not, I would vote against it, but, you know, you do this and we may not, you know, ratify this. And it creates this large block. And what's the potential? And I think there's no doubt in my mind, Virginia knew that there would be a lot of people in the ratification debates. They didn't realize it was going to go down that path. I think that decision was made a little bit later, that they would use the conventions to ratify this instead of the state legislatures, or they may have already started talking about that. But nevertheless, there was still a serious doubt that Virginia would accept the Constitution if it eradicated slavery. That would have been four states right there guaranteed no. And what's 4 minus 13? That gives you 9 states. Now you still have Maryland, which actually is a slave state. Delaware seemed kind of sympathetic, right? And so, you know, there was this real possibility that there may have been a serious divide in the Union between the North and South. Even though there was on the issue, the point was that they were trying to maintain the Union. Now, General Pinckney of South Carolina declared it to be his firm opinion that if himself and all his colleagues were to sign the Constitution and use their personal influence, it would be of no avail towards obtaining the assent of their constituents. South Carolina and Georgia cannot do without slaves. As to Virginia, she will gain by stopping the importations. Her slaves will raise in value, and she has more than she wants. It would be it would be unequal to require South Carolina and Georgia to confederate on such unequal terms. He said the royal assent. Now, this wasn't just about importation. Mason was basically talking about slavery itself. He said the royal assent before the Revolution had never been refused to South Carolina and Virginia. He contended that the importation of slaves would be for the interest of the whole Union. The more slaves, the more produce to employ and carry trade. The more consumption also, and the more of this, the more of revenue from or for the common treasury. He admitted it to be reasonable that slaves could be dutied like other imports, but should consider a rejection of the clause as an exclusion of South Carolina from the Union. Mr. Baldwin of Georgia, this is why I tell you where these men are from, so you kind of understand their paradigm, right? Mr. Baldwin had conceived national objects alone to be before the convention, not such as like the present were a local nature. Georgia was decided at this point that the state was always hitherto supposed a general government to be the pursuit of the central states, who wished to have a vortex for everything that her distance would preclude her from equal advantage, and that she could not prudently purchase it by yielding national powers. From this, it might be understood in what light she would view an attempt to abridge one of her favorite prerogatives, slavery being her favorite prerogative. If left to herself, she may probably put a stop to the evil. Now, that's just, there's no evidence of him, why he would say that. As one ground for this conjecture, he took notice of the sect of blank, which he said was a respectable class of people who carried their ethics beyond the mere equality of men, extending their humanity to the claims of the whole animal creation. Now, this is obviously, you know, some religious doctrine he was talking about, and Madison just left it blank. Now, I don't know. I'd have to look at his notes to see if he left that blank, but it's blanked. Minister Wilson of Pennsylvania observed that if South Carolina and Georgia were themselves disposed to get rid of the importation of slaves in a short time, as had been suggested, they would never refuse to unite because of the importation might be prohibited. As the section now stands, all articles imported are to be taxed. Slaves alone are exempt. This is, in fact, a bounty on that article. Mr. Gary of Massachusetts thought, "We had nothing to do with the conduct of the states as to slaves, but ought to be careful not to give any sanction to it." Again, remember, he's an anti-federalist. And so that was political theatrics right there. Mr. Dickinson of Delaware considered it as inadmissible on every principle of honor and safety that the importation of slaves should be authorized to the states by the Constitution. The true question was whether the national happiness would be promoted or impeded by the importation, and this question ought to be left to the national government, not to the states particularly interested. If England and France permit slavery, slaves are at the same time excluded from both those kingdoms. Greece and Rome were made unhappy by their slaves. He could not believe that the southern states would refuse to confederate on the account apprehended, especially as the power was not likely to be immediately exercised by the general government. Mr. Williamson, you can see this, I mean, he really kicked the hornet's nest, right? Mr. Williamson stated the law of North Carolina on the subject, to wit, that it did not directly prohibit the importation of slaves. It imposed a duty of $5 on each slave imported from Africa, 10 on each from elsewhere, and 50 on each from a state licensing manumission. He thought the southern states could not be members of the Union if the clause should be rejected, and that it was wrong to force anything down not absolutely necessary and which any state must disagree to. And so we're in the middle of this. And, you know, we miss you, Paul. I know that Paul would love to be a part of this because, I mean, just reading this for yourself and hearing this argument just spinning around the room actually is very insightful. So folks, we'll be right back after this this quick promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Now, one of the things that kind of came to me while I was sitting there just, you know, cogitating during the break, not saying anything, that as, you know, as we look at this snapshot of time, you know, I've told people and I tell them all the time that just like today, they were divided. I mean, there were real reasons why these states were very different and why, you know, there was no desire for some of these people in their states to move to another state because the religion was different, because the labor philosophy, their economic philosophy. I mean, these were almost like, you know, completely different families on the block that, I mean, and you've kind of seen this or you may have experienced this where, you know, a couple of families move in, you know, in a area that people have been neighbors for a long time, and it's almost like a family culture or a tribe, and then these outsiders move in, and it's like they're completely different. They're completely different religions. They think differently, and you go, oh, my gosh, you know, who are these strangers in our land? They were very divided. But you can see, and this, the reason that I came up with this is because Mr. Rufus King's comment. They understood that they were heavily divided, that there was no way they could actually convert these people to their religions and to their philosophies. So they accepted their differences. In other words, the formula of success in today, just like it was back then in politics, is to put aside one's differences, to put aside one's self-interests, and actually unify on the common good or those common principles that they all did adhere to, liberty being principle. Now, many people, either unwittingly or ill-informed, tell us that the Constitution was biblically based. The Constitution was based upon the laws of nature and nature's God. These were the principles that these men agreed upon. When we talk very specifically about biblical, this is where Madison and many others basically said, well, whose Bible are we going to go by? We're going to go by mine or yours? Because they didn't like your Bible and you didn't like their Bible. And so, and we have these types of things dividing us. You know, as long as we allow ourselves to be divided, and in the Patriot movement, it is the most divided group of people on the earth today. And the one person who's laughing, I mean boldly laughing at us in our face, is Satan. Because that's exactly what he wants. United we stand, divided we fall. So when we look, and this is, I can't emphasize this enough, when you look at an institution that refuses to yield to any other institution on these same principles we all agree upon, then they are the problem, and you need to divorce yourself from them. When you run into somebody, because I deal with these people, if you want me to name names, we're going to actually start putting it up, and I need to actually put the names of those people who speak ill and are divisive and refuse to unite on the Constitution. Because it doesn't meet their needs. They want to go through the paths. They, you know, let's use the party, let's use this, but don't hold the public servants fully accountable to the Constitution. Don't use petitions. Don't audit the Constitution and call out all of our public servants for all of their transgressions against the Constitution. Don't look at that color-coded Constitution that identifies the violations. And those people are the deceivers. Those organizations are the deceivers. They're in our ranks, and they are dividing us. This is why I constantly call and I plead for all of these people that are subject matter experts in medical freedom and the Second Amendment. Put down your myopic issue. Bring your expertise and help us write these petitions. Get behind all of the petitions. Don't become an obstructionist and say, we only care about this and this petition only, because they've just admitted that they don't care about the Constitution. They only care about their issue. And that's because that's what puts food on their table. And this is the danger of people making a living in this milieu. We've got all the, it's like evangelical ministers that are going to preach to the people that want to hear the very specific word, and they're happy to take your money. But don't try to bring in any other topics. We only talk about this. And that right there is a deceiver. So anyway, back to this. Mr. King basically said this. He thought that the subject should be considered in a political light only. In other words, he was unifying. We need to look at this in a political light. If two states will not agree to the Constitution as stated on one side, he could affirm that equal belief on the other, that great and equal opposition would be experienced from the other states. He remarked on the exemption of slaves from duty whilst every other object was subjected to it, as an inequality that could not fail to strike the commercial sagacity of the northern and middle states. You know, I'm actually highlighting this. I got to tell you, as we go along, I highlight these words. That statement right there speaks to the fact that, you know, we're divided and we can always take these exceptions constantly. We need to figure out how to unite. We need to unify. Mr. Langdon of New Hampshire was strenuous for giving the power to the general government. He could not, with a good conscience, leave it with the states, who could then go with the traffic without being restrained by the opinions here given that they will themselves cease to import slaves. In other words, he didn't trust them. I'm telling you, these men knew how to actually incite and, you know, insult people in a very civil way. We have lost civility in our nation. General Pinckney of South Carolina then thought himself bound to declare candidly that he did not think South Carolina would stop her importations of slaves in any short time, but only stop them occasionally as she does now, or as she now does. He moved to commit the clause that slaves might be liable to an equal tax with other imports, which he thought right and which would remove the difficulty that he had started. And apparently he's admitted that he started this. Mr. Rutledge of South Carolina, if the convention thinks that North, South Carolinas and Georgia will ever agree to the plan unless their right to import slaves be untouched, the expectation is vain. The people of those states will never be such fools as to give up so important an interest. He was strenuous against striking out the section and seconded the motion of General Pinckney for a commitment. Now, let me keep in mind, let me help you remember this. The people in these three states, now Georgia was kind of unique because Georgia was limited to 100-acre plantation, or 10-acre plantations. So there may have been somebody that went out and bought the land from this person, bought the land from that person to aggrandize a grape plantation. But in all of the other colonies, it was 100 acres that was initially granted to somebody when they came here as an indentured servant. Now, when we look at these men at this time stating that they must import slaves, that was the affluent. How many people had large plantations and large bodies of slaves in each of these states? I would love to see somebody actually do the demographics. How many farms were, recorded? Because every plot of land, there's a level of tax. And, if the person was actually paying the tax for their poll tax, then you would actually see those records. So here's the question. How many people were actually, are we talking about? That I believe that it was only those few people that had the affluence and were regular poll taxpayers, that they were the ones that were influencing and driving this nation into the ditch. There's no doubt in my mind, if somebody actually goes off and does an academic study out of these states, you'll probably find that the elitists that had the large plantations were the ones that were holding back America. Elitists, just like Bill Gates, just like all of these elitists that we have today. Elon Musk, I was going to say it with an F, but Zuckerberg, and all of these guys, what's his name, Dewey or whatever, the former Twitter, CEO, all of these elitists, all of them, are basically holding America back and driving us in an unconstitutional, illegal direction. They're destroying us, and they're violating the Constitution as citizens. They're actually they're committing an insurrection, and we're divided over these stupid issues. Anyway, Mr. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania wished the whole subject to be committed, including the clause relating to the taxes on imports and to Navigation Act. These things may form a bargain among the northern and southern states. Mr. Butler of South Carolina declared that he would never agree to the power of taxing exports. Mr. Sherman of Connecticut said it was better to let the southern states import slaves than to part with them. If they made a sine qua non, and I have no idea what that means, I could look it up, but anyway, he was opposed to a tax. You get these words that are Latin or what have you. How many people read Latin today? I wish they would restore Latin as a language in school. Anyway, back to this. He opposed to a tax on slaves imported as making the matter worse because it implied they were property. He acknowledged that if the power of prohibiting importation could be given to the general government, it could be exercised. He thought it would be its duty to exercise the power. And this is why they ended up putting that clause in, because the general government did have and does have in the Constitution the power to regulate commerce coming in. Mr. Reed of Delaware was for the commitment, provided the clause concerning taxes on exports should also be committed. In other words, they were kind of coming up to this irresistible force and the immovable object, right? Mr. Sherman of Connecticut then pipes in, observed that the clause had been agreed to and therefore could not be committed. Mr. Randolph of Virginia was for committing an order that some middle ground might, if possible, be found. He could never agree to the clause as it stands. He would sooner risk the Constitution. He dwelt on the dilemma to which the convention was exposed. By agreeing to the clause, it would revolt the Quakers and the Methodists and many other states, having no slaves. On the other hand, two states might be lost to the Union. Let us then, he said, try the chance of a commitment. On the question for committing the remaining part of Section 4 and 5 of Article 7, now this, the style committee, or at some point in time, they actually start condensing all of this. And this is how it goes, of Article 7. Now, New Hampshire, no. Massachusetts abstained. In other words, they didn't vote. Connecticut, yes. New Jersey, yes. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Maryland, yes. Virginia, yes. And North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, yes. So it was 8-3. And so Mr. Pinckney and Mr. Langdon moved to commit Section 6 as to the Navigation Act by 2/3 of each of the houses. Okay, so Mr. Gorham of Massachusetts did not see the propriety of it. Is it meant to require a greater proportion of votes? He desired it to be remembered that the Eastern states had no motive to the Union but a commercial one. They were able to protect themselves. They were not afraid of external danger and did not need the aid of the Southern states. Now, just remember, what this is a firing of the shot across the bow here. What he basically said is the Northern states, because they're making their own ships, they're the ones that are freemen. There are no slaves up in the Northern states, these Eastern states. And so they were the ones that did the bulk of the fighting of the Revolution. Now, everybody knows that the Southern states, because of the slavery, they cannot let many of their men go because they have to control their slaves. Because the desire innate in all men to be free, these slaves will revolt or do what's necessary so that they can enjoy freedom, like all men. And so they're really basically saying, go ahead, let us split. And as a matter of fact, when we go through the ratification debates, these arguments come forward. Let us split. We can actually defend ourselves. Let them be taken over. And then when they give up slavery, we will come and save them because they will need us to do that. Anyway, Mr. Wilson wished for a commitment in order to reduce the proportion of votes required. Mr. Ellsworth of Connecticut, the Anti-Federalist, was for taking the plan as it is. This widening of opinions has a threatening aspect. If we do not agree on this middle and moderate ground, he was afraid we should lose two states, with such others as may be disposed to stand aloof should fly into a variety of shapes and directions, and most probably into the several confederations, and not without bloodshed. And he's making a very good point. Again, he's talking about unifying. On the question for committing the sixth section as to the Navigation Act to a member of each state, now New Hampshire said yes, Massachusetts yes, Connecticut, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, yes. Delaware, yes. Maryland, yes. Virginia, yes. North Carolina. So it was basically all of the states except for two that said no for committing Section 6 to the Navigation Act. The committee appointed Mr. Langdon, King, Johnson, Livingston, Clymer, Dickinson, Martin, Madison, Williamson, Pinckney, and Baldwin to the committee. And they were referred also the two clauses above, which mentioned the fourth and fifth section of Article 7. Now, that's just, we don't know what those were unless we actually had them in front of us. And they were all fluid anyway. So anyway, Mr. Rutledge of South Carolina, from the committee, whom were referred on the 18th to 20th, instant the Instant, the propositions of Mr. Madison and Pinckney made the report following. And here he inserted the report. The committee report that, in their opinion, the following additions should be made to the report now before the convention, namely, quote, and this is what they actually provided. At the end of the first clause of the first section of the seventh article, for payment of the debts and necessary expenses of the United States, provided that no law for raising any branch of revenue except what may be specially appropriated for the payment of interest on debts and loans shall continue in force for more than blank years. They actually left it blank. At the end of the second clause, second section, seventh article, add, and with Indians within the limits of any states, not subject to the laws thereof. So in other words, these are amendments or insertions that they were putting into these different arguments, these different articles. Quote, at the end of the 16th clause of the second section, seventh article, add, and to provide as many become necessary from time to time for the well-managing and securing the common property and general interests and welfare of the United States in such manner as shall not interfere with the governments of individual states in matters which respect only their internal police or for which their individual authorities may be competent. Then also add at the end of each section, 10th article, add this. He shall be of the age of 35 years and a citizen of the United States and shall have been an inhabitant thereof for 21 years. Then the next thing is they're going to add after the second section of the 10th article, insert the following as a third section. The President of the United States shall have privy council and shall consist of the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the Chief Justice, the Supreme Court principal, and this kind of goes on. I realize that they're just giving this report of all these different changes. So forgive me for reading that too far. Mr. Gary of Massachusetts urged the necessity of this prohibition, which he said was greater in the national than the state legislature, because the number of members in the former being fewer were on the account of being more feared. Mr. Governor Morris thought that the precaution as to ex post facto laws unnecessary but essential as to the bills of attainder. Now, an ex post facto law is basically coming along and saying something that was illegal is now illegal, and we're going to punish you for doing something that you could have, that you legitimately were doing, and that you legitimately are doing. It's kind of like what they're doing with wells today. You had these wells, and now they're coming along saying it's illegal to have a well. That's an ex post facto law. A bill of attainder and or a bill of punishment, and in a bill of attainder, it is a capital, you know, you're executed. If you violate this law, you're executed, or you are punished. So bills of attainder, execution, or punishment. These are bills that go after classes of people. A good example of that is those people who chose not to get vaccinated are to be punished by not being able to travel, by not being able to do these things. Those concepts were repugnant. Going after people because they exercise their free will or because they're a part of a certain class. And as actually, when you look after the 14th Amendment, any law that actually went after and isolated whites and blacks, these separatists and so forth, in essence, that spirit was a bill of punishment by segregating people. They did not have any authority to be able to do that. The Constitution did not grant segregation. So by passing a law that actually separated people because of their race, because of their gender, or anything like that, there's no enumeration for any of those forms of demographics in segregation or anything, then the fact is the federal government could not pass any laws to allow those types of punishments. Now, because of the 14th Amendment, no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges or immunities of a U.S. citizen. which means that now states couldn't do that. States could not support these segregation laws. They could not support these types of things. So anyway, Mr. Ellsworth of Connecticut contended that there was no lawyer, no civilian, who would not say that an ex post facto laws were void of themselves. It cannot be necessary to prohibit them. Mr. Wilson inserting, and I think it's important that we had that there because most people don't even understand it because they're passing laws that do exactly that. Anyway, Mr. Wilson was inserting anything in the Constitution as to an ex post facto law, it will bring reflections on the Constitution and proclaim that we are ignorant of the first principles of legislation or constituting a government, which would be so. The question being divided, the first part of the motion relating to bills of attainder was agreed to without contest. On the second part relating to ex post facto laws, Mr. Carroll of Maryland remarked that experience overruled all kinds of calculation. It had proved that in whatever light they might be viewed by civilians or others, the state legislatures had passed them and they had taken effect. If these prohibitions in the state constitutions have no effect, it will be useless to insert them in this constitution. Besides, both sides will agree to the principles and will differ on its application. Mr. Williamson of North Carolina, such a prohibitory clause is in the Constitution of North Carolina, and though it has been violated, it has done good there, and it may do good here because the judges can take hold of it. Dr. Johnson of Connecticut, as he points out, that it's the judges that kind of, you know, steer that ship because it's in the Constitution. They should use that. But many times, and it's actually been proven that using the court system to actually adhere to the Constitution has been fruitless. It literally has become fruitless. Dr. Johnson of Connecticut thought that the clause unnecessary and implying an improper suspicion of the national legislature. Mr. Rutledge of South Carolina was in favor of the clause on the question for inserting the prohibition of ex post facto laws. And so this is how they voted. New Hampshire, yes. Massachusetts, yes. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, yes. Maryland, yes. Virginia, yes. North Carolina divided, and South Carolina, yes. And Georgia, yes. So it carried with 7-3. The report on the committee of five made by Mr. Rutledge was taken up and then postponed that each member might furnish himself with a copy. And then the report of the committee of 11 delivered and entered, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, and so they're kind of wrapping up the day. And as we kind of go through the end of this, I have it all highlighted. You will want to go through all of this. But since we're out of time, we're going to dive tomorrow into the militia on the next day because that's exactly what they dive into. And this is where they really do a deeper dive again on the militia as they did before. And this is where we're going to see how they kind of explain the importance of the militia and the relationship between the states and the state's militia. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.